I'm here in Beleek and I'm talking to Tommy Gallagher. Tommy, have you always lived in Beleek?
Yeah, I was, most of my life, I was born in across the border in County Donegal, just outside of Ballyshannon. I came to live at Beleek when I was very young. I don't remember it. About 3 year old, I think.
My good. And what was your father doing for a living?
He was a farmer.
And where did you live? Or what was the address of?
Well, the address was Keenahan Beleek, and that's where I live, and where I set up a home in the same townland.
So you've never really travelled that far in that sense.
In that sense, no. I know the area well.
Okay, and you were educated here, and born into what tradition?
A Catholic family. Both my parents were Catholics, and I went to primary school in Beleek, and then I went to post-primary school in Belfast and St. Malachy's College as a boarder. Spent some years there, and then I eventually ended up in Belfast taking a teaching qualification. My part of my younger life was elsewhere.
Okay, and so when you left school then, you were born in 1942, so you would have left school sometime in the mid-50s?
Early 60s,
actually. What did you go on to do then?
I qualified as a teacher in 1965. And then I began teaching in the local secondary school here, St. Mary's Brolla, where I spent most of my teaching career. And then I was involved in politics. I was involved in the setting up of the SDLP in County Fermanagh in 1973. And then I went into public life in 1989 as a councillor. And then I ended up being involved in the early political talks during the 1990s under different secretaries of state like Patrick Mayhew and Peter Brook, and then involved in the talks after the ceasefires when Sinn Féin became involved, and then the Good Friday Agreement, working with George Mitchell and others there for quite a while.
So your life was steeped in politics, really?
Well, quite a bit, quite a bit. I felt, growing up here, I grew up in a house where everybody was respected, regardless of background, that it was never an issue, and I felt that stood to me in good stead wherever I went later on, particularly in political life.
Who introduced you into your political life?
That was a Beleek man here. His name was Tom Daly. He was a brother of Bishop Edward Daly's, he encouraged me to join the SDLP when it was being set up, and he became a councillor here for Beleek, and he was involved in the first attempts at power sharing the 1970s. He was a local representative in the assembly at that time for a few years, but the violence was ongoing at that stage, and it didn't really last.
And when the civil marches and the Good Friday, the bombing in Derry happened, Bloody Sunday, it started to escalate after that. How did you help? Because you were, at that time, you were a young politician, you were involved. So can you remember those early days, what you were doing?
I was a branch member and supporting Tom Daly, like I said, and Austin Curry. And I took part in local civil rights marches in Enniskillen. You mentioned Bloody Sunday. I remember, the strength of feeling then, and indeed anger. was so powerful at that time. You know, we organized a local march here just to the local RUC station, which is now closed, and handed in a petition expressing our feelings about what had happened. So doing work like that, and I felt always one of the most important aspects of that work was supporting John Hume, and later John together with Seamus Mallon, because I felt what they were doing was something that through my own makeup I appreciated and felt was worthwhile, and that it was the right thing to be doing. So that kind of support, and then when an opportunity came later, then I went to represent the SDLP as a public representative.
All right. Tell me where you're... How did the early troubles affect you?
I suppose, like, it affected... Generally, first of all, like, it affected everybody in this community, you know, just get up in the morning and listen to the news, and there was some atrocity carried out by men of violence. That could be loyalist violence in parts of the north, or republican violence, and that violence often resulted in death and anger, and it kept going on, and our local area wasn't immune from it either. There were various incidents, you know, an attack on the police station where somebody was killed, or an attack on security force personnel.
About a personal attack in you?
I was part of that general feeling of anger and despair about what was happening. In the 1970s, I remember about 40 yards from my home. At that time, the military here were driving about in armoured cars, and bombs were set in culverts along the roadway by Republicans, and one of them exploded one day when an armoured car was passing by about 40 yards from our house. Myself and my wife and the children were at home at the time, and we got quite a fright. First of all, there was a soldier injured, but not seriously, as it turned out, and not fatally. We were completely shocked and stunned at first. The ceilings were down, the glass was in. I remember a passerby coming in to see were we all right, and he didn't even have to open the door. The glass was all blown out of it. He just stepped in through the debris. Two of the children had been playing out in the garden. They had come inside. Fortunately, I didn't know they were in at the time. In fact, my first reaction was, golly, they're outside. And when I went out, we found them in the house, and that was great relief. When I went out then, later, to the garden, it was full of big rocks and large stones that had been just scattered everywhere. And, just by the grace of God, the children had come in. Otherwise, some of them might well have been killed. And I remember my brother, Raymond, who was going with the tractor to bring in bales, and he had some workmen with him sitting on the trailer, and I learned afterwards they were ready to go into that very field where the bomb went off, only someone else asked him to do something with the tractor, and he had said to the folk with him, you know, I'll be back in 20 minutes. So we could have had fatalities in the family, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So, but did that explosion and what happened, did that put you and your wife and your children for the rest of the troubles under that kind of wanting to make sure that you're okay, just all the time alert.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. You know, that did spur another reaction, you know, and a fear that this is going to be repeated somewhere else close to our house, you know, and perhaps, you know, somebody might well be killed out of all of this, you know. Yeah. And it was also pointless because it didn't change anything. The security personnel were there on the ground. Their presence increased, and that then very often spilled over into, you know, maybe an overreaction from the security forces when many local people were stopped and searched and delayed and harassed, because with the security forces and the police at that time, their first reaction was their own personal safety, and then all of that built up into more difficulties and more polarization amongst the community, you know.
And skirmishes in the town where bullets were flying?
Sometimes, yes, that frequently happened, and there were deaths. You know, I remember we were sitting within yards of the hotel here, and I remember the soldiers would often, when they would be out on patrol and come back down the street, they were very open here from the Free States, just here to my left, and at that point they had no cover, and they used to just sprint out into the open and back into the cover, you know, to get back to their base. And I mean, there were a couple of soldiers shot. I can remember one Sunday afternoon, one soldier shot dead there. It was a sniper over here to my left and across the bridge. And there were several other deaths, security force deaths as well.
Did that seem normal at that stage, you know, or did you grow into that accepting what was happening?
No, I wouldn't say. Certainly in my case, and you know, the case of my family, we didn't grow into accepting it because we understood that it was all pointless and futile and was not going to achieve anything. And we weren't the only ones. My sense was that was a widespread feeling amongst the people in the community, and I mean that eventually did, I think, bring pressure on paramilitaries.
Yeah.
You know, that they had to find another way, that they could go on and on, but they weren't changing anything.
Were you personally bitter about the fact that the IRA almost killed your children and blew your house to bits?
Well, very angry about it at first, and thankful that it hadn't happened, and believed that, you know, there was divine intervention. In that case, it was a miracle.
Yeah.
We think both myself and my wife Eileen accepted that, and not bitter or seeking revenge or anything. Angry and like determined that to do what we could to change the mindset of the people who were doing that.
And so what did you do in politics that you know, to make that difference in those days?
Oh, okay. Well, then in 1989, when the troubles were really as bad as they have been at any point, I was elected to the local council here. And that then, I think, gave not just me a voice, it gave a voice to the community. Mm-hmm. I was able to act on behalf of people from all sides of the community, people from the unionist community who felt threatened because they were living in a border area where the numbers were heavily against them as well, people in my own community, of course, who I knew from being in touch with them they wanted an end to this, and I was a strong campaigner for ending the violence and pointing out the futility of it. And then through John Hume and Seamus Mallon, I was involved in political talks in the early 90s, and then later on the talks leading to the agreement and all of that. But being an elected representative then gave me access to people in charge of the security forces, where maybe they were intimidating some people in the local community. I was able to meet with commanding officers and indeed the Secretary of State, and that in some cases proved very helpful, you know, in getting a change in how they conducted themselves while they were billeted here in Balik.
And your community, your town is in very close proximity to the border.
Right.
So, I mean, that must have posed a problem here at the time, too.
It did. It certainly did. Not least, sometimes, security force incursions across the border, you know. Sometimes that may have been deliberate, yes, but there were some... In other cases, it was a completely innocent. These people from Wales, England, or Scotland were over here. Or they were just sent over here, and they really didn't know where the border was. You know? So I remember on some occasions, even they were across the border, and they were actually stopping people to question them. You know, so in many cases there were difficulties around the border, but the security forces in the south, the guard, were very helpful and very supportive as well. And many occasions I met with them about some problems that arose at the time.
And so did when you were, as you say, leading up to talks and to peace, did you feel that it was too prolonged and that, you know, that it was getting frustrating at times to bring sides together? Did you feel like that?
No, and that may seem a bit strange. Yeah. But from working closely with people like John Hume, as I've said earlier, I knew what he had in mind and how hard he was working to bring people together. And I really felt optimistic, particularly once we got to the ceasefires, because he had a lot of support globally as well for what he was doing, and that was very powerful. But he was a marvellous and gifted individual as well, and a very hard worker. I remember at the talks sometimes these papers were circulated and so on, and we'd go off to a room then, and maybe there would be a few voices of despair, well, you know, that'll never work or whatever. But John was rarely there while we were doing that. And then he'd be off around the corridors, and he'd come in and say something like, well, I met Trimble there. And, you know, I think, you know, we'll be able to change that particular paragraph a little bit, or met Adams or whatever, you know. So that always lifted our spirits, having somebody like that, you know. And in many cases what he told us actually worked out okay, because he had that kind of bigger reach politically, and he gained the trust of I'm sure practically all of the parties represented, you know, at that time.
Did he have communication benefits? Was he a good communicator, John Hume?
Yeah.
With yes. Tremble and...
Oh, yeah. I mean, and they knew where they stood with him, and what he said was his word, and, you know, there would never be any kind of coming back to change that or undermine it once he... But that all came, I suppose, because he clearly understood where we should be going and what we should be doing, you know.
Yeah, and who were the main drivers of this? I know John Hume is in there. Who else was there that was driving this towards success?
Well, I suppose my sense was that almost every group or party represented there at that stage were interested in having an outcome, a better outcome anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I had no doubt about that. Maybe it might have been hard work at times with some of them, you know, who maybe felt they were going too far or they shouldn't go too far, that they were going too quickly even. But
imagine that. But while all that was going on, you had the victims of the violence.
Yes.
And so they were dying, they were being blown up and shot, and the talking was going on.
That was the talks in the early 90s, pre-ceasefire. Republicans weren't at those talks because of the violence. Seemed a bit strange that talking was going on and the people who were involved in violence weren't in the room. You could say that, but there was very good and useful work done then, and there was, like I've said, trust developing between, certainly between, a level of trust between the SDLP and the Ulster Unionists, who were the largest parties back then, and it was worthwhile, because then I think that did bring pressure on others who...
How difficult was it to bring Sinn Féin in from the cold, so to speak?
The SDLP were only one of the parties that were trying to persuade them. As we know, the governments were trying to persuade them. There was an American influence. All of that. What made a big difference was the electoral results in 1992. There was a Westminster election. If you looked at the nationalist side there, the SDLP, who were involved in the talks leading, like I've mentioned, when Republicans weren't involved, the early talks, the results there were very convincingly in favour of the SDLP and their message, and I've been outlining what that was, even here in Fermanagh, South Tyrone. Where there was always a split nationalist vote. It was my first Westminster election, and Ken McGuinness was the single unionist candidate, so there was always the usual outcry from nationalists about the vote being split, and I finished ahead of the Sinn Féin candidate that on my first outing, you know.
How did you manage
were, there
that?
Were similar
how did you get that vote?
Well, there were similar results in Mid-Ulster, for example, as well, where Dennis Hawley was the candidate then. Well, it was the message, really. And as we know, party leaders are important in developing and spelling out the message, and then my own message as well. which was very much about the futility of violence, and I made it very clear I didn't support what Ken McGuinness was doing either, but at the same time had to combine that with the message that Sinn Féin trying to continue with a military wing,
yes,
as well as standing in elections, just was it was really a waste of everybody's vote, and I succeeded in getting that across. And then by the time the next Westminster election came round, we'd come to the ceasefires. So that was one turning point.
And did you find, though, that after all of this, you were left with the legacy of the Troubles? And how are you going to handle that?
Do you mean how are we going
how
to handle it now?
To, yes.
Now?
Now that you're left with people who are... Who were badly affected by the Troubles.
Yeah. Well, handling that now is the biggest challenge that this society has. Now, we were one of the parties very strongly in favour of victims and truth and reconciliation and all of that. And while it is in the Good Friday Agreement, it hasn't been developed the way it should have been and given the priority that it deserves, because there are so many people hurt and disillusioned, and as things stand at the moment, we have two parties now who are not able to agree, and that makes it difficult to implement aspects of the agreement that have to do with the needs of victims. And in my view, even though we have two political parties who are so divided and seem to have managed to polarise many in the community as well, I think the needs of victims has to be brought back more to grassroots level. Work, I think, between local communities and include civic society in that, and I also include people in the churches. I think that's where a great deal of work now needs to be done to try and heal the hurts that are there. And I mean, hopefully there will be funding opportunities from, as there has been to some extent, from both governments and from the EU, even though things are a bit up in the air now with Brexit. But we hope that certainly they'll be able to still ensure that the commitments of the Good Friday Agreement are honoured. But time is going on, and there are people who are victims of the trouble who have sadly passed away, and their families are left with all that hurt. And I see more and more the truth in what I've often heard suggested, that unless that is dealt with, then we'll see history repeating itself. And I think that should be a concern at the front of minds, much more than I see it at the present in the political sphere anyway.
Right. We can certainly learn from what happened. We can learn from the past, really.
Yeah.
But you must wake up in the morning now and know that I don't have to look underneath my car. I don't have to worry about violence in the north. And that must be a comforting feeling too, to get to this stage.
Well, yeah. That has to be acknowledged. But It's like everything else in life, if you're standing still, you're losing. And I think just in community life, it's the same. Those needs have not been addressed. We're losing because of that, and we see this polarization.
And just tell me one thing, Tommy, before we finish. Yeah. Your village, your town here, has it the effect of the last 30 years of violence? Mm. Has it, how its effect on the town? Has the town suffered because of that, or have you managed to pull together and to continue?
Well, there's always been a good community spirit here, and that still prevails. I see it in everyday life here. I mean, don't misunderstand me. It might be a funeral, it might be some other church service. You see the communities coming together, and then at other events in life, that's pretty good. But we have people here who are victims of the Troubles, and just their needs, despite all that, are not being addressed. And the
is that right? And so they're going around with their heads down and not getting the opportunity then?
Well, I'm not sure with their heads down, going about quietly, but they deserve to be heard just the same as everybody else does.
Yeah. So when did you retire?
In 2011.
You backed down?
Well, I lost out in my assembly seat. I'd defended it in three previous elections, but it just didn't work out, you know.
Oh, was that part disappointing?
At the time it was disappointing, but it's political life, so...
Who did you
be expected? Sinn Féin. I'd always held a seat here for the SDLP, so in that election there were three nationalist seats, two SDLP and one, two Sinn Féin and one SDLP was always the outcome, but just the last time Sinn Féin got three, you know. So.
And is that kind of shifting the balance a little bit, do you think? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, obviously, you're going to say it's a bad thing, but what I'm saying.
Look at it was an election to the assembly, and I mean, where's the assembly? There's more Sinn Féin in it. There's more DUP in it, and there's no assembly.
Yeah.
So, we're all here dangling.
Tommy, thank you.
Right, Morris.
Tommy, I'm back here again with you, and I was just chatting and catching up on what we spoke about before. Okay. So can I continue by maybe talking a little bit about your sport career? You played here with Fermanagh for how many years?
I played with Fermanagh for about a dozen years at least, you know, during the 60s and part of the 70s.
And did you have any success in those years?
Not much with Fermanagh, no. And unfortunately, we're still waiting for success at senior level. So we didn't. But nevertheless, I enjoyed it. And
so you played football and hurling?
I also played hurling for Fermanagh, yeah.
And it all started here in Beleek, did it, with a local club? Or?
Well, yes, I started here in Beleek at underage level, and then I was away at college, and my post-primary education was at St. Malachy's in Belfast, and that's where I picked up the hurling skills and...
What was the GAA like here? What was the strength of the Gaelic games locally?
Well, it was wonderful as far as I was concerned as a young fella, you know, from 16 up to through my teenage years. It was just an outlet and provided fantastic opportunities to be involved in competition and just to meet new people and to be out and about. So, and it was very different GAA in those days, you know.
Wasn't a way of expressing yourself too, as you know, because politics were coming into it in a big way.
Well, yes, there was that to it, all right, and it was playing the national sport, and as we know, according to the constitution of the GAA from the outset, it was established on an all-Ireland basis, which was a wonderful thing, and at that time, just myself and those around me as well felt it was wonderful just to be part of an all-Ireland organisation. That side, we were playing the national sport, and then there was all the excitement that went with just being a player and involved in heady days when we won maybe a championship or something like that.
Was that necessary, Tommy, to have that sense of belonging, sense of place?
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
In your own area.
Oh, well, absolutely. And I think that was a great thing in my own formation, looking at it narrowly as an individual. I felt I owed a great deal to the GAA because of just the whole ethos within the GAA and the things that I've mentioned.
Yes.
And a good character formation, and I felt it was something that stood to me then in later life, particularly in political life, where recognition is very important. And I had already that advantage in having played inter-county football for years, you know, as well as hurling, that I had lots of contacts, and it made the transition into public life easier too.
So in your political career then, in canvassing, you had built up all the...
Well, I was a kind of known face, so that was good, you know. While sometimes some of the things in the GAA didn't particularly please me later on about maybe, you know, how venues were used and that kind of thing for...
In what way now?
Well, you know, at the... for commemorations and so on, we've read of GAA grounds being used by other people who want to commemorate some events of a Republican nature, perhaps. Now,
did you not agree with that?
I didn't. I mean, nothing against commemorations, don't get me wrong there. Everybody is entitled to have commemorations for somebody who has died, particularly their family. I have no quibble with that at all. But the GAA, my understanding of it, it was always non-political, and they changed that to non-party political. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful organisation. I didn't agree with everything that happened in the GAA. But
there was a situation here, Tommy, mm-hmm. Where there was a commemoration and a monument put up for the three IRA men who were shot and killed. Mm-hmm. And now whether they were shot locally or not, I'm not mm-hmm. sure, but the plaque, the monument mm-hmm. was put up very close proximity to where a builder had been shot and
yes,
killed.
Yes.
You know that story.
That's at Baleek here.
At Baleek.
Well, I know it very well because I was right caught up in it all.
Well, and tell me how you were caught up, Tommy.
Well, I was caught up because there were two workmen. They'd been working at the barracks at Baleek. It was an RUC barracks then. That was pre the new policing dispensation. And they were on their way home, and they were ambushed and shot, I'd say, within 200 yards of where we're sitting right now. So then, it was around about 2000 or the turn of the century, there was a monument put up at the spot where, near, just right almost on the spot where they were killed, but it was commemorating IRA volunteers who had lost their lives, not here in the immediate vicinity, but elsewhere in Fermanagh. So that was a very controversial thing. I was the elected representative for the area, so I made my views known on it very clearly that it was inappropriate to have a monument erected there where two Protestant workers had been murdered, and that it was offensive to the families of those who were murdered, and that no commemoration is of any use if it's causing offence to somebody else.
How did that go down locally?
Well,
I
was happy with the outcome. It was a tough time for me. There were letters in the local papers and all the rest criticising me for my stance. But in the end, the good sense on the Republican side led to an arrangement where the people who had erected the monument or were responsible for it, they quite clearly accepted the arguments that I've been putting forward, and they moved the monument, and it's now away miles from here on a minor road.
And was that done to antagonise, to annoy the family?
I don't know, and I wouldn't say that it was done to antagonise them. It was done, I think, more to commemorate these IRA people who had lost their lives. Now, in my view at the time, thing was just far too sensitive, mm-hmm. and the monument shouldn't have been placed mm-hmm. there. So that was I made my case, and the monument was moved after some months. So at least
there was a
resolution.
Yes,
it was a tough time because I was the one who was getting the flak from people, I presume, Republican sympathisers.
And I heard that there was
how I was approaching this, you know. But yeah. I mean, I have no regrets about it. What I was doing was the right thing, and today it'll be the right thing, and tomorrow it'll be the right thing. You can't really say that you're commemorating somebody if you're offending somebody else who has lost a loved one.
When you were canvassing around, Tommy, did you go as far as Garrison? Was that...
That's only over the road.
Remember? Yes, remember? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so are you aware that, you know, there were a number of families who were intimidated from that area and had to move?
Yes, oh yeah, yeah. Like, well, that was well known and widely known, yes, yes.
And that's when you were just kind of setting off in your own political
career. Well, yes, I suppose some of that coincided with when I was setting out on my own political career.
Was that seen as a kind of a victory for, you know, that these people now had left their farms and moved inland?
Well, if somebody claimed it was a victory, I certainly tried to disabuse them of that point of view, because everybody's a loser in situations like that. And But that was the way it was then. There was a lot of fear about, and people didn't, the Protestant people didn't move away from the border, you know. The Catholic community here, the whole area was saturated with troops, and there was lots of abuses of people's rights by the military as well. You know, all part of this so-called war, you know.
Yeah, and you were trying to play very much middle ground, were you, in your...
Well, it wasn't, I suppose people would call it middle ground, but, I mean, I would call it just plain, sensible way to approach things, you know, because it was clear to me and to lots of other people who supported me then, that, I mean, there were going to be no winners in this, and it ended up there were no winners.
No, because the uprooting of the McVitties, the Kerrs, the Longs, the McClures, yeah. They're all families that were evicted.
Well, they were forced out, yes. Uh-huh. I mean...
Was that part of ethnic cleansing?
Well, it was a form of ethnic cleansing, all right, in that there was a particular ethnic group being targeted and forced to move elsewhere.
And you
fits
say
that definition?
Yes, and so it was them against us. Is that the way it was perceived? Was it the nationalists against the Protestants? Was it a sectarian?
My own view on it was there were many in the Catholic population who did not at all agree with that or support that or have any time for it. But it was there was so much fear and everything in around the border and all the rest that...
And who were doing... were the perpetrators? Were they people from the Republic coming up here, or were they local lads?
Well, I suppose it was a sense that it was a Republican movement that was responsible for this, and, you know, threats were issued, and threats were taken very seriously in those days, and, you know, we received threats of different kinds, you know, and kind of had some experience of myself not having to move home.
How did you? You were telling me about your threats. Can you? What kind of threats?
I mean, just sometimes the phone would ring there, and it might be silent, or some man would come on the phone and say I was talking a load of rubbish. You know, the boys are doing a good job. Something like that, you know. And I'd say, hello, what's your name? You know, you who think this, are you prepared to give me your name? I said, if you're not, get off the phone, you know. Just that's an example of the kind of experience that, you know, not very nice when your family are young and, you know, it's near bedtime.
Was it stressful?
Sometimes maybe a bit stressful, kind of, you know, I knew that it was something my family would be upset about. And I think they're stressful in that way, you know.
Of course.
I wasn't absolutely foolhardy either, you know. I mean, I did think sometimes I'd better be careful, you know.
But
I was offered, I was offered police protection and so on, but I thanked them for that, but I declined it, you know. I just felt that...
Why did you decline that now? Is it because you felt you were a Catholic nationalist? Is that it? And, you know, that you didn't need the Northern Ireland police protection?
No, I understood, you know, why they were offering protection and all, but I just hoped somehow or other that I felt that would have complicated life enormously for myself and my family, and I didn't think it was worth
drawing attention to you. That
certainly would have done that, yes. And it would have just complicated life because, you know, I don't know what it's like police protection,
but
I just hope to avoid that.
I know we're running out of time, but just give me another thought. What was it like then? You know, because you were setting up this new party. SDLP.
Yeah.
And so you were... You told me in the last recording you had a lot of time for John Hume and his work and what he was doing.
Yeah.
So what was special about that party that you can put your finger on and say, this is why I'm supporting that party and running with that party?
Well, because I'm of Northern Ireland. I was born just close to the border in Donegal and lived practically all of my life here, and I grew up in a house where we were Irish and very proud of it, but we had Protestant neighbours and we respected them, and I never heard any sectarian comments being made in the house during all of that time. So just respected people, and to me it's a case of, I mean, we have to live together here eventually when all the arguments are...
Hasn't gone away, has it?
No, they're there. But at the end of the day, we can only move forward together. I mean, I believe in a united Ireland. That's what I want to see. But I know that there are others who have a different identity, and they will take convincing and, you know, frightening them or pushing, trying to force my identity on somebody else. It just doesn't work with people anywhere, and it's certainly not going to work here where the communities have been so badly divided for so very, very long.
So
and the work of healing,
yes,
really, it hasn't begun yet in many respects. It's little steps been taken, but we have a long, long way to go.
And Tommy,
we have to work together.
Yes, of course. But why so? Why so did your party do so badly in the last election?
Well,
because it's middle ground, isn't it? Really?
Well, there isn't any middle ground now. That's the problem for Ireland, particularly for Northern Ireland, and when the extremes are in the ascendancy, well, one then tries to outdo the other, and we see the outworkings of that now, you know. And two prime ministers over here yesterday, and they just had to walk off home again, you know. So we're all, but I mean, that's politics and life, and people are there now, but at the end of the day, to have progress here and to achieve this united Ireland that I would like to see, then I don't know how long it takes, but we're going to have to review all of where division and one-upmanship is getting us. It's back to what they used to call the zero-sum game.
Yes.
And the only hope is working together, and doing that in a respectful way.
But having somebody thrown out of their house and uprooted and their cattle sold off and the farm is gone, I mean, it's pretty hard to turn around and shake hands with the person who did it.
Well, this is I mean, that's what they call the legacy of the Troubles, which, I mean, some people still haven't understood how that legacy runs from one generation to another, you know, until it's dealt with. And it's the same on both sides. I mean, there are people, innocent people, killed by police, killed by army, and their families still haven't got anything like justice, and some of them haven't even gone inquests. So all of those things are there, but
there are people walking the street here, Tommy, in Balik.
Yeah.
And they, at one stage, would have been involved. And then they have to, and then, you know, you have to, you know, as you say, live in that community. How do you expect that Protestant neighbor is going to walk, you know, past without feeling some kind of bitterness or some kind of mistrust?
Yeah. Well, that's part of the problem when there is a violent conflict. And, I mean, Ireland has had, over the centuries, I suppose, too much of that, really. But the best thing we can do at a political level is to work together. And there's very little sign of that at the moment, unfortunately. But you're right about all the problems that are still carried over from that conflict, and how hurtful it is for some people. There's no easy answer. It's going to take time. But I think people have to learn to work together, because
and sorry, and I know you're in a hurry. Yeah, the last question, the very last question. Mm-hmm. We're sitting down here in Balik, where Balik factory has been here since for so long,
1847.
Yeah, and this was the management was very nationalist and Catholic, wasn't it?
I think there was always a bit of a mix, you know. But
Catholics were implied here. Well, that's what I'm suggesting.
Because I mean the area is heavily nationalist anyway. But you have to be very clear, though, that people from all sides of the community worked here and worked here together.
And was that seen here so as one of these coming together, you know, this is very much part of a reconciliation where people did, you know, work together.
Yes. Well, I mean, the pottery employed people from all religious backgrounds.
Yes.
And people from both sides of the border. So it was kind of, the workforce was cross-community and cross-border. And that's still the case, you know. There wasn't any issue about that, you know. Everybody was.
It survived without being.
Everybody was happy with that. Well, yes. Yeah, indeed. And for people who were into damaging property and damaging places of work and all the rest. The great strength of this place was, as I've said, it was cross-border and cross-community, and very difficult then for somebody to try and damage that, because they just would be faced with a massive outcry.
So. Tommy Gallagher, thank you. Thank you for your extra time.
Thanks.
You.